first thing you need to do after, I mean, obviously, whatever's gushing, you stop, you clamp a Band-Aid on. But after that, your first priority should be finding the facts. That's what we did in the savings and loan debacle. We found out why the failures occurred, and we addressed it. That's what we did in the Great Depression with things like Glass-Steagall from PCORA, and we addressed it. Well, are we going to do that now? Are we going to find the facts? This stuff about, oh, we need to be forward-looking, we don't want to dwell in the past. What would happen if we treated air crashes that way, folks? Oh, no, no, we're not really going to investigate why that plane came down. Just, and we want you to know that planes are safe. And we've done a stress test, you know? Right. That would be a disastrous strategy, right? Our strategy has produced, of looking intensively at every major crash, has led to aviation being extraordinarily safe despite the recent Air France disaster. It's time we take financial world as seriously.
Well, let's go to Q&A. And
I understand Barney Frank 5-10 years ago was pushing very hard for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to go into subprime and pushing them to push the banks to push. This was a way to get a lot of people into homes. So I haven't heard tonight government source of problem. Government as a regulator, as a solver, I've heard. But I see a lot of government source here as a cause. Can you address that?
Sure. There are two things that people generally try to argue in terms of the government as a, I'm sorry, there's three things, as a source of the crisis. The first is Greenspan's easy money policies, right? So they blame him for keeping interest rates very, very low. That has some truth in the sense that it aggravated it a bit. In other words, it made leverage cheaper. And the greater the leverage, the greater the bubble, and the greater the loss. So there's some truth, but that's still pretty marginal. The second thing that people sometimes argue as government a source is the Community Reinvestment Act, right? That has nothing to do with this. That one's pure made up. How do we know that it has nothing to do with it? Well, first, it's been in place for, I think, close to 30 years at this point. So if it was going to produce disasters, it's not a very good explanation of a current crisis. Second, 80% of the non-prime loans were made by non-regulated entities not subject to the Community Reinvestment Act. So obviously their behavior wasn't in any way prompted by the Community Reinvestment Act. Third, the institutions that were regulated and were subject to the Community Reinvestment Act, none of them had any CRA rating problems. So they weren't making these loans to try to improve their ratings. They all had great ratings already. Fourth, what changed in CRA regulation over the recent period relevant to the crisis? It was weakened, not strengthened, right? As a result of Phil Graham's actions, primarily as part of the law that repealed Glass-Steagall, the Graham Bleach-Lilly, they also weakened the law on CRA. And then under the Bush administration, does anyone seriously think the Bush administration made enforcing the Community Reinvestment Act a regulatory priority? No. Did they regulate anything effectively in safety and soundness, which is what they were concentrating on? No. I assure you, there's nothing coming on the CRA side. So that one is completely made up. The third one is Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie do have a role in this crisis, but it's not the one that most people think about. Fannie and Freddie, ironically, were the primary reason we didn't have a crisis in subprime much earlier, because Fannie and Freddie only purchase prime mortgages for packaging. And Fannie and Freddie's standards for prime mortgages in general are very good. That's a conforming mortgage in jargon. And so in the old days, the non-prime folks couldn't sell their stuff because only Fannie and Freddie could buy it. What changed? we passed a law that allowed what we call private label folks to create mortgage-backed securities. So these are primarily investment banks. And it's the investment banks that purchased the non-prime loans and then sent it to the rating agencies, like I said, and got the triple A's. So it's overwhelmingly, again, a story of actually the weakening of the creation of competitors to Fannie and Freddie that led to this. But Fannie and Freddie did purchase not loans, not subprime loans, but these exotic derivatives that got the AAA ratings, primarily liar's loans. And it did so, of course, at a time when the agency had full regulating it, which was then OFAO, OFAO, OO, had full regulatory authority to stop it and was run by a conservative or Republican. And not only did he not stop it, he thought this wasn't risky. You know, so, and it is true that the administration, the Bush administration, strongly pushed this stuff.
Well, that was the ownership
through
society.
The FHA.
Yeah, but the ownership
that was the ownership society and such.
And it ended up that it's the biggest transfer of wealth from the poor and working class in history.
Right. So Barney Frank definitely a supporter of Fannie and Freddie. He's far from alone. It's bipartisan support in Congress and strong support from the Bush administration, and probably would have been strong support from the Obama administration as well, except that they pretty much ruined their reputation. But they are massively insolvent because of the CDOs they purchased.
Okay, on this side, the second gentleman in next from where you are, the second one, you're the first. But
thanks.
Hi.
But you're number one, even if you don't get to ask.
You get to be next. I worked with back in the mid-90s, and I asked the guys at the Office of Thrift Supervision, why didn't they let the SNLs go bankrupt? And they would never answer the question until I was on the elevator with my boss one time, just he and I alone, and he said, John, very simple. We were terrified the entire system would collapse. I said, so you're telling me you let Bill Simon, all these guys, buy those assets 10 cents on the dollar and flip them 30 days later? He said, yeah, we were terrified of the banking system collapse. And so that, to me, seems one of the biggest concerns of why these people have done what they've done. But I have another question. On the weekend of 12 September last year, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy at 2 o'clock on the morning of Monday, the 15th of January. By 12 noon, J.P. Morgan Chase had transferred to them, it's like 80-some-odd billion dollars. Okay, they transferred back to Lehman. Then by 5 o'clock that same day, the Federal Reserve Bank, through Geithner, reimbursed J.P. Morgan Chase for that $80 billion. They did the same thing the next day. Lehman was technically in bankruptcy as of 2 o'clock Monday morning, yet they're getting paid by J.P. Morgan Chase. Federal Reserve is reimbursing them. I've never heard of that before in my life. I've queried the guys at Bloomberg and others. No one seems to know what the hell is going on here. What happened?
Okay. So the first one, we spent the insurance fund down to $500 million. We were insuring supposedly $1 trillion in deposits. And it happened because the administration, I'm talking, by the way, this is 1986-87. And we used all that money to close the worst control frauds. So we were operating on fumes. And indeed, we did worry every morning that there would be a nationwide run. But President Reagan refused to allow us, A, to say that the insurance fund was insolvent, and B, to seek any public funds. So, you know, that was our constraint, and we did the best we could under that constraint. I don't know the facts on your point. The most obvious thing is there may have been overnight funds, right? And if they were overnight funds, then you would have to ship them back the next day under the what's called the automatic stay provisions of the bankruptcy laws. So it's conceivable that it's less conspiratorial than you think. But if there was, in fact, a federal guarantee paid out, that would indeed be very interesting. The broader point that, you know, are the Fed and the Treasury working with the big banks hand in glove? Yeah, of course they are.
And aren't they favoring Goldman Sachs? It's the alumni seems to be.
Yeah. Well, they favor friends of Goldman, Foggs.
Right.
So.
The lady in the back there, just behind you there with a hand up. Yes.
I just had a comment. What is this doing to our nonprofits? If you look at the board of directors of all the big nonprofits, they're all these criminal CEOs, and they don't just behave this way and govern this way by day and then put on a different hat.
Well, sure they do.
You know, I don't hear it enough said that these people are considered pillars of society, and what are they doing to our nonprofits?
Well, there can be pillars of salt, if I remember the Bible correctly. And, obviously there's been a long-time strategy of you put rich people on your board, and it's expected that they will make or have their corporations make very substantial contributions, right? And you expect them also to encourage their employees to assist the nonprofit, and they adopt a particular nonprofit. Nonprofits themselves, of course, can be control frauds as well. The Baptist Foundation of Arizona was a classic Ponzi scheme, right? I've been concentrating here because of the economic crisis only in the corporate sphere. But yes, it occurs there. And in response to the gentleman's earlier question, government can be a control fraud and frequently is. I assure you that I am not naive about the difficulties of government. After all, one of the proposed charges against Speaker Wright was his effort to fire William K. Black for having the audacity to blow the whistle on him. So, yes, government has severe limitations as well.
This gentleman down here in the front with the blue shirt.
If Obama isn't sensible, really? If Obama isn't sensible enough to follow your advice, what lies ahead for us?
I think if they continue down this road, that it will be a one-term presidency. I think that there will be the logic of the bailout gets bigger and bigger, and you have to do more and more games. Apropos the gentleman's up above's earlier question. And because it's done in such a opaque way, and we do actually benefit folks who are least deserving, I think it's going to produce a scandal. I don't know why it hasn't produced more of a scandal already. We secretly, through AIG, the single biggest recipient of the secret off-the-balance sheet bailout was Goldman Sachs at $12.9 billion. And it was done at a time when Paulson, who had been Goldman Sachs CEO and gotten it into trouble by putting it into the subprime, used Goldman Sachs as Treasury's consultant about what to do with AIG. And, you know, that I don't understand why that isn't a massive scandal. We simultaneously bailed out UBS, a giant Swiss bank, for $5 billion secretly through AIG at a time when we were prosecuting UBS for defrauding the United States of America by aiding tax evasion by the wealthiest of Americans. And we fined them $780 million, I think it was. But we gave them $5 billion. So we paid our own fine and gave them $4.25 billion in walking away change.
Why? Graham's on the board, right?
And they're not insured. Remember, AIG is not FDIC insured. We owed not a penny. I don't understand why the folks who go crazy about immigrants don't go crazy about, you know, sending $5 billion to UBS.
On this side, where's the microphone? Just right next to you there.
I've got a two-part question. There have been, in recorded history, over 8,000 fiat paper currencies, and all of them have failed. And, you know, of course, the Fed is currently in charge of ours for almost 100 years. And they've debauched our currency to the rate of about 96%. And I like your analogy of the melamine in the baby formula. I liken that to Federal Reserve notes, whereas mother's milk would be likened to a hard currency. And my question is, what is your opinion of a hard currency versus the current system where our birth certificates are monetized, which is where human capital comes from, which is where the term in war collateral damage comes from? And my second question would be, what is your opinion of H.R. 1207, which is Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed?
To answer the second question first, I'm one of the academics at the top of the effort to get signatories on the Paul bill. So the first one, I obviously in this setting I can't do very lengthy, but I'm not in favor of a gold standard. Gold standards produce even more severe economic crises, and they make it very hard to recover. And recovery rates for those on gold standards out of the late Great Depression were actually worse than folks on what fiat, which is a term of art, currencies. So, no, I'm not in favor of your ideas there. There we diverge, but on the second one, I'm all for you.
Do you have a total figure of the losses from the entire credit bubble worldwide or in the U.S.? And do you have a time projection on when the penny drops?
The estimates vary by the IMF and others, but in the order of magnitude of $4.5 trillion.
But what about there's been apparently, at least on paper, there's $9 trillion that's gone out of the stock market. There's $5.5 trillion that's gone out of housing. I mean, aren't there...
Those are not included.
They're not included.
As wealth losses. This is how much to fix the losses in basically the financial institutions. I agree to you, the total impact economically is much larger than the $4.5 trillion. Not that $4.5 trillion isn't a lot.
Right. Well, you got to measure that against, what, $11 trillion GDP? Or what's the economy?
The U.S. economy?
Yeah.
I think it's more like 14, but
14,
yeah.
Okay. All right.
Oh, well, what's left to drop is a whole host of things that we were talking about. Hungary, virtually all mortgages are denominated in, I think, euros, but people are earning in the lower in the local currency, which I think is the florent, something like that. And, of course, the local currency has lost value massively relative to the euro. So, you know, they're just going to be default after just a nationwide default. Iceland has 70% of its commercial loans denominated in a foreign currency.
They were the British depositors, right? They went into their banks.
British depositors went heavily, but other nations did as well. It's not what you asked about, but it exposed huge regulatory holes in the European context as well. So part of the answer is we don't know because no one has been effectively examining banks in places like Hungary and Iceland. To give you stress tests, people mentioned, Iceland did a stress test of its three big banks in August of 2008, said they passed with flying colors. The entire nation collapsed in October. AIG did stress tests and said the worst conceivable loss was $900 million. Hey, what's $200 billion among friends? Fannie and Freddie were required by statute to do stress tests, much tougher stress tests than Treasury recently used, announced in August of 2008 that the worst conceivable losses were $5 billion. Close, no cigar. You know, the question is whether it's going to be $200 billion or $400 billion for them. So these stress tests, all this really fancy modeling where we literally took rocket scientists, physicists to do the modeling, the financial modeling. It purports to be accurate to the seventh decimal point to the right, you know, the seventh figure to the right of the decimal point. The only thing is it's wrong to the seventh figure to the left.
Gentleman here, right next to you. Back there. There he is, on your right.
I have a question regarding the role of the Federal Reserve in the economic crisis. The question is, do you agree with the Austrian school economists that the Federal Reserve has caused this recession and virtually every recession since 1913, its inception, by manipulating interest rates and the money supply? That's basically
no.
It.
Okay.
No.
Why is that?
I don't know. Well, it depends on what you mean by manipulation, but whether or not people were on gold standards, they managed to have crises long before any central banks existed. And indeed, the gold standard makes it very difficult to recover from crises. There is a real problem with what we call theoclassical economics, in which it has become pretty much a religion, and it can't be falsified. So I read the quote. I gave the quotation earlier about a rule against fraud was not necessary or even particularly important. That was by the deans of the law and economic movements in the United States of America. A literal dean, Dean Fischel of the University of Chicago, he's now moved on, and Judge Easterbrook. They wrote that after they had tried to apply their theories in the real world, in the savings and loan crisis. And in the real world, they had praised Lincoln Savings, Fischel had, as the best possible savings and loan in America. So after getting it completely wrong, they write the book that becomes the treatise on all of this that affects policy, that has been falsified entirely by events, and they don't even mention that they tried applying their theories in the real world, and they got a 3,000 position error. In other words, they took the worst SNL in America of 3,000 and said it was the best SNL in America. You can't get it more wrong, and for that, they made him dean of the University of Chicago Law School.
So
it's not a cabal, it's not a room, but it is shared beliefs that say you don't need to regulate anything, that private market discipline will ensure that everything will go fine.
That's what Greenspan's excuse is.
And that was what Greenspan, now he's done a mea culpa at least.
Well, he said, I'm surprised that it didn't work.
He said he was shocked. He thought that it was shocking that people, you know, that would, you know, you'd actually have fraud. And this brings back, of course, the classic Casablanca moment.
Right. Okay, the lady up here with the white sleeves and the hand up.
Always wear distinctive clothing when you come to these events.
Thank you. I'm still trying to understand if what you're saying is that the reason in the face of this flagrant, widespread, in-your-face fraud is cover-up. Okay, so if it's cover-up, you know, don't say anything, you'll lose your reputation. All right, that's majorly what's going on. Why can't we call that conspiratorial?
Well, what difference does it make? I mean,
well, because it is. And what's wrong with calling it that? Why, you know?
Well, I think the idea
I think
would be
the problem is
jail,
tactical. That as soon as you say it's a conspiracy theory, you get dismissed by most folks. You don't need. Let's take the savings and loan stuff, right? There were frauds all the time that were known as "I'll trade you my dead horse for your dead cow." You got to love Texans, right? And this is, I've got a really bad loan, and the pesky examiners are requiring me to recognize losses. And if they require me to recognize losses, they'll take me over, and it'll all be bad for me. And you've got a bad loan, the same thing. Well, I'll buy your bad loan, and you buy my bad loan, and we'll both buy them for above original book value. So the losses will disappear, And like an alchemist of yore, it will be transmuted into a gain. Now, those folks do meet the literal definition of a conspiracy, right? They got together and they conspired. And in fact, in Texas, there were meetings of some of these sleazoids, and they did have a common representatives, it being Texas again, right? But in another sense, none of it was necessary, right? They had a community of interest. And it's just, I'll scratch my back, you scratch my back. They didn't need to meet monthly. They got together informally in bars and such, and they had a problem, you have a problem. We all have some drinks, and we solve our problem.
Okay, the lady there, and this will be our last question.
Okay, you know, you talked about the fact that there are not enough regulators, and I'm just wondering what regulations still exist for them to enforce. Glass-Steagall is over. You know, the uptick on the market is no longer in existence, and you said the Community Reinvestment Act has been weakened. What are the regulations that exist at the moment, and what is Congress talking about in terms of creating more regulations?
Okay. During the crisis, they still existed all of the accounting rules that said you had to comply with generally accepted accounting principles, and none of these people complied with generally accepted accounting principles for obvious reasons. When you have massive mortgage fraud, it inherently leads to massive accounting fraud. Right, that's indeed the goal. And in addition to that, banking regulators have the authority to take action against any unsafe and unsound practice. And we deliberately kept that very broad because we know any specific prohibition, it's easy to evade, right? You just put a little fillip on and it's something different. So they could have used that safety and soundness. And as a result of real reforms adopted in response to the savings and loan crisis, the banking regulatory agencies, and this included the Office of Thrift Supervision, had substantial enforcement powers to seek civil money penalties of hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars to remove and prohibit officers forever from all of the banking industry, to take cease and desist orders. When I was a lead enforcement director, we had in a single year, I think it was over 800 enforcement actions in savings alone. As you would expect, serious enforcement actions essentially ceased as long as the guy in charge is going around with a chainsaw saying that and promoting the Daryl Dokos of the world, who was the guy that had been demoted 7 levels out of the savings and loan stuff and is brought back and then is tossed out of the agency again when he permits IndyBac to backdate documents to make its accounting look better.
So political will is what's needed, and Obama's survival depends on it. So,
well, there are a lot of better regulators. They're experienced, effective regulators. They were, you know, not in charge. There's no reason they can't be put back in charge.
So let us thank our guest here tonight, Bill Black.
You've been listening to A Public Forum with William K. Black. He teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He's a former bank regulator. He spoke in Los Angeles in June at a forum hosted by radio broadcaster Ian Masters. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude with our next installment of The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion and the Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. We'll be continuing in Chapter 7 that's titled The Age of Reunion. Last week, Eisenstein examined some money systems that would promote cooperation and facilitate the fulfillment of the needs of people as well as the ecosystem, instead of thwart them as the present system does. The restorative economy. A money system does not change in isolation. Everything else must change with it, both as a consequence and as a precondition. My logic in the previous section is not, if only we could change our money system, then everything else would change too and our problems would be solved. No, it's rather part of a vast phase transition, a gestalt, a holographic repatterning in which we could take any aspect as a starting point, and indeed must, in a linear narrative such as a book. Together, the shifts in money, property, education, medicine, art, and others that I describe in this chapter all arise from and are part of a general reconception of self and world. I've started with money, but that doesn't make it primary. As explained in Chapter 4, much of the destructiveness of our present economic system is due to the externalization of costs, which, like interest, attempts to impose a linearity onto nature. Externalization assumes an out there that is the start and end point of linear consumption. Whereas interest demands endless growth, economic externalization assumes an infinite reservoir of resources and absorptive capacity to accommodate that growth. Interest and externalization are, in fact, two sides of the same coin, a connection that has gone largely unnoticed by those who hope to halt our species' self-destruction through internalization of costs. Nonetheless, proposals like green taxes, consumer leasing, and pollution permits offer considerable insight into what an industrial economy might look like that no longer sees itself as apart from nature. I borrow Paul Hawkins' term for this, the restorative economy, because it not only halts but also reverses the progressive distancing of ourselves from community, ourselves and nature. One way it does so is by motivating technology that mimics, strengthens, and extends the processes of nature rather than seeking to deny them. Writers such as Hawken, Herman Daly, Bill Rees, Lester Brown, Tom Hartman, and Kenneth Boulding have made the seemingly obvious point that no economy is sustainable that consumes energy and other resources at a faster rate than they can be renewed. They view the consumption of fossil fuels, along with other finite resources, such as the ecosystem's capacity to absorb waste, as a depletion of capital. Sustainability, an overused word which really means survival, is only possible if we live off our current income, not our capital reserves. This income includes solar income, in addition to the Earth's ability to convert pollutants into the building blocks of new life. We might also include the cultural income of new art forms, new ideas, and so on, which today are instantly co-opted and commodified along with the capital reserve, quote-unquote, of our heritage. Our economic paradigm separates us from nature through its linearity, its demand for endless growth, and its reduction of nature into, quote, resources. It also separates us from each other through its consumption of social and cultural capital. An economy that reverses this separation will have a key defining feature. There will be no such thing as waste. The whole idea of waste, garbage, etc., that there is an out to which to throw things, that idea can only exist within the mindset of separation. If there is to be no waste, then everything we take from the biosphere must be returned to it in a non-toxic, non-accumulative form. One proposal to implement this is Braungart and Engelfield's intelligent product system, which attempts to implement the ecological principle that waste is food through 1. A leasing economy for durables. 2. Complete non-toxic biodegradability of consumables. And 3. Permanent storage charges for any other waste. You can still produce dioxin if you want, but it is yours forever. The first means that consumers lease large appliances such as refrigerators and washing machines instead of buying them. In effect, they buy services, refrigeration, clothes washing, instead of the machine themselves. This removes the structural incentive toward planned obsolescence while creating new incentives to make products easy to repair and recycle. The same logic applies to industrial durables and is especially potent in the context of a demurrage system because it de-emphasizes capital accumulation. The second principle is fairly self-explanatory, with the caveat that many supposedly biodegradable substances do not degrade because they are suffocated in landfills. The third principle is essential for making the first work, because it creates a huge financial incentive to make products non-toxic and recyclable. The effect of an eternal storage fee is even more powerful in the context of a demurrage-based currency, in which future costs are not discounted. As well, storage fees for toxic waste create an incentive to develop processes to render it non-toxic. The mycologist Paul Stamets has developed some amazing bioremediation techniques involving fungi that can detoxify many classes of toxic waste. However, since the social and ecological costs of toxic waste are nearly all externalized, at present his methods have limited economic motivation. In a restorative economy, Stamets might well be the richest man on the planet. To foster cyclicity in the industrial economy, author Paul Hawken advocates green taxes, modeled after the proposals of economist A.C. Pigou. Exemplified by the fossil fuel tax, these would impose a large surcharge on the cost of natural resources, reflecting the damage generated by their extraction and use. The tax on oil, for instance, would incorporate the cost of habitat damage in drilling the well, the apportioned costs of oil spills, the cost of air pollution from its burning, and so forth. In practice and in principle, this approach is fraught with difficulties. The practical difficulty is in calculating long-term, highly distributed costs, such as economic damage caused by global climate change, to which oil burning contributes, but not as a sole factor. The difficulty in principle lies in assigning monetary value to such things as species extinction, the destruction of beautiful views, and human mortality. Gesell's monstrous doctrine of value rears its ugly head again. The assumptions underlying green taxes once again involve the denomination of everything in monetary units. Nonetheless, green taxes are intended to eliminate the profit strategy of dumping costs onto another. They are the financial embodiment of the realization that what we do unto another, we actually do unto ourselves. We are not separate from the world. Today's economic system fosters the opposite belief, because damage dumped onto society or the environment does not usually end up as a cost on our own balance sheet. Pigouvian taxes encourage a more expansive sense of self. The immediate practical effect would be to encourage alternatives which are presently uneconomic only because the price of, quote, natural resources doesn't reflect their true cost. All of a sudden, the marvelous green technologies, bicycles, composting toilets, organic agriculture, photovoltaics, zero emissions plants, grass roofs, hypercars, rail transport, fungal bioremediation, sailing ships, non-toxic industrial processes, and many more would benefit from huge economic incentives. Today, we attempt to force manufacturers to reduce pollution through regulation and control. Green taxes would eliminate the need for regulation by aligning ecological sense with business sense. When humanity internalizes the damage of present industrial processes, these processes must change dramatically. Mining and quarrying will become prohibitively expensive, as will the refining of ore when it is unacceptable to leave behind mine pits and slag heaps. Our main source of raw materials might be the junk of the 20th century. A pound or more of lead in every TV set and computer monitor, the vast amounts of iron and steel rusting away in junkyards, the cinder blocks of demolished buildings. What durables we produce will be designed to be easy to repair and maintain so they might last hundreds of years. Enormous entrepreneurial energy will pour into such endeavors as the objectives of business come into alignment with the restoration of nature. In contrast, the regulatory approach to environmental protection puts it in opposition with business success. Material goods of plastic and metal will become so precious that to simply throw them away will be unthinkable. Not only containers, but the entire distribution system for their contents will be designed in the interests of reusability, not because the government requires it, but because it will be the sound business practice. Because such services as cleaning and refilling are by nature local, less capital will be exported to distant large-scale manufacturers, strengthening local communities and expanding the viability of local mutual credit currencies. The entire suburban landscape will change when gasoline, cement, and asphalt are no longer artificially cheap. The community-enhancing high-density principles of contemporary urban design will no longer fight an uphill battle against developers' economic interests. Without subsidized fuel, pesticides, and irrigation groundwater, local produce will become economically more competitive, and home gardening will gain an economic incentive in addition to its present aesthetic and spiritual benefits. Food production will become more local, and more people will become food producers. For local travel, the bicycle, which is still undergoing technical improvements, will come into its own as the primary transportation technology of the future. Ultimately, I think that the construction and maintenance of bicycle trails is the maximum incursion into nature that is socially and environmentally sustainable. Just look at the carnage that goes into building a road, the bulldozing of trees and tearing into the earth. In the future, we will not be able to bear anything more than modest bicycle paths. Certainly, current levels of roadkill, perhaps the most direct reminder that externalities equal death, would be intolerable to the conscience of any sane society. Is it mere coincidence that normal bicycle speeds, say about 20 miles per hour maximum, also the natural speed of a Wunnerf intersection, also delimit the pace of mindful travel? At bicycle speed, I can still notice what plant species grow on the wayside. I can react quickly enough to avoid running over rabbits, and I am moving slowly enough to enter briefly into the social universe of those I pass. There is time for a hi, a token of acknowledgement, a flash of recognition. Anything faster entails some degree of oblivion to the people and places traversed, all the more when traveling in an enclosed vehicle. Automobiles, no matter how low their emissions, distance us from nature simply by their speed, of which roadkill and habitat fragmentation are inevitable byproducts. Cars, and even more dramatically airplanes, allow us to go from point A to point B, without truly experiencing the places in between. They allow us to travel without journeying. No wonder we are so oblivious to the spaces in between the matrix of human culture and so numb to their destruction. Unexperienced, casually traversed, sped by and flown over, it is as if they did not exist at all. Externalities. Unfortunately, the ecological economy envisioned by Hawken and others is fundamentally at odds with our money system. The former seeks to eliminate externalities, the latter requires and creates them. The former requires the cycling of all material, the latter has a built-in imperative of endless linear growth. A green economy can never exist except marginally in the context of interest, which demands endless growth, the one way and therefore unsustainable conversion of all the world into money. On the bright side, the unsustainability of our industrial system and the unsustainability of our financial system are converging, presenting the opportunity for the transformation of both. In place of today's linear or exponential economy will arise a cyclical industrial ecology that will be, in concept as well as fact, an extension or a new dimension of nature. In no sense will it be unnatural. Like a plant or a whole species, each business enterprise and each industry will seek not the maximally efficient extraction of resources, but to serve an essential function in an interdependent web of relationships. Any step in the cycling of resources will be a viable business opportunity. Paul Hawken has compared the economy of the last few centuries to a field of weeds which, entering barren soil, do indeed seek maximum growth in a headlong competition for sunlight and other resources. Quote, at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, a vast new world of apparently unlimited natural resources became available for the taking. By constructing an economy that demanded ever-increasing supplies of all resources, humans successfully mimicked the process of a newly formed ecosystem. Like pioneer plants, we were aggressive and competitive. We emphasized untrammeled growth and didn't worry about efficiency, conservation, or diversity. Close quote. Obviously, this can only be a temporary phase. Eventually, increasingly complex, interdependent relationships among species develop as the original opportunistic colonizers give way to a more diverse, mature ecosystem. Quote, in immature systems, most energy is used to create new growth, so that bare soil is quickly covered. In a climax system, the greater part of energy is devoted to the continuation of the existing plant and animal communities. Close quote. We are at the cusp of just such a transition. Already, even with the money system that demands constant growth, and even with our conceptual distancing from nature, nascent industrial ecologies are forming within a linear framework. When we integrate the parameter of cyclicity into the system, these will gel into an ecological economy, the equivalent of a diverse jungle ecosystem of hundreds of thousands of mutually reliant species, as opposed to a field of thistle and burdock, competing to cover bare ground. In such a system, each niche is self-limiting. Success lies not in taking as much as possible for me, but in fulfilling one's role in the maintenance of the whole, a mission that calls forth the unique gifts of each participant. To define each person not by what they can keep and possess, but by what they can give, ending the age-old contradiction between service and selfishness, greed and giving. Yes, there will always be competition, just as there is in the jungle. However, it will not be the destructive competition that seeks to enclose the commonwealth and fleece the chumps, but rather a constructive competition to excel in a given niche, to be a greater contributor to the common good. Already we have these ideals, but must fight for them against the grain of economic self-interest. When the conception of self that underlies the economy changes, then so will economic self-interest realign itself toward the common good. The restorative economy is not a matter of passing some new legislation, implementing some reforms, or seeing through the errors of conventional economics. It's nothing less than a facet of an all-encompassing spiritual transformation of our fundamental relationship to the world. Martin Prechtel explains that in Mayan cultures, it was necessary to pay back to nature the debt incurred in the creation of any material object, and indeed in the living of a human life. The greater the disruption of nature, the more ritual effort required to pay back the debt to the other world. Thus, an iron knife would demand lengthy and elaborate rituals in consideration of the cost to nature of its forging, the digging of the ore, the burning of fuel, and so forth, so much so that no one would make a knife without very good reason. Such things as air conditioners would, in this worldview, demand so much ritual recompense as to be prohibitively expensive. A limit to consumptive technology was thus built into the Mayan culture. What would happen if you mass-produced knives, as we do now, without paying the price in ritual? The knives would exact payment in their own way, either through direct physical violence or through the reduction of human life, hope, vitality, creativity, joy, and beauty. Can we say that this has not already come to pass? In other words, when we produce and consume linearly, without regard for the consequences to the other, the planet, and the rest of life, we unavoidably amass a debt that must inevitably be paid. One technological fix after another only postpones the day of reckoning. Just a few more drinks to prolong the buzz only brings a worse hangover in the end. The all-important myth of the ascent of humanity, the technological program, is that we can put it off forever. Yet the bankruptcy of this myth is increasingly obvious. I am not advocating that we imitate Mayan rituals, but that we translate the idea into a context that makes sense today. The ritual price to be paid translates into devoting care, consideration, and thought into anything we make. For there to be no leftover debt requires that this consideration cover the origin of the raw materials, the effects on the ecosystem of producing and shipping them, the effects on people's lives, the effect the use of the object will have, and how it will eventually return to the earth. Translated into economics, it requires the full internalization of all costs. If we neglect any of these considerations and allow costs to remain external, then consequences will surely come to haunt us. A debt will be written into our future because there is no out there to which to externalize. Can you imagine, then, the enormous debt that our society has amassed over the last few millennia? While it may seem that we have escaped more or less scot-free and passed the debt on to future generations, which is bad enough, the truth is much worse. We pay the price ourselves, too. The price comes out of our own flesh, and worse yet, out of our souls. The just reward for our ignorant, arrogant, deluded despoilation of planet and culture is the ocean of suffering that engulfs our species, the wars and atrocities, rape and genocide, the brutalized children, the slums of the third world, the lives without hope, the diseases and famines, and in the rich countries, the depression and despair, anxiety and ennui, anemia and loneliness, the tragic reduction of human potential that leaves even the winners of the rat race among the sorriest rats of all. An interesting parallel to Prechtel's view that the spirit world underlying nature takes its payment in the form of human violence and suffering can be found in the cosmology of G.I. Gurdjieff, who called it food for the moon. Gurdjieff's prescription for human development, to act in the full consciousness of self-remembering, is also consistent with Prechtel's prescription for a ritualistic approach to life. The true ritual is not a sequence of steps performed by rote, but a means to induce mindfulness and expand consciousness beyond the limited self that reached its extreme in Western culture as Descartes' I Am, Adam Smith's Economic Man, and biology's phenotype. Indigenous culture never reached anything near that extreme of separation, but they did recognize the tendency and took active steps to counteract it. Remember the Yurok story of the Woge in Chapter 2, who knew how to live in harmony with the earth? before they departed, quote, because they knew that humans did not always follow the laws of the world. They taught them how to perform ceremonies that could restore the earth's balance, close quote. Ceremonies or rituals allow us to internalize psychologically the cost of our actions, in effect paying the debt right now instead of postponing it that it might be taken from our souls and the lives of our children. Here again is a parallel with Gurdjieff, whose primary prescription for recovering mindfulness was intentional suffering, by which he meant an unwavering intention not to avoid or escape the consequences due. On a psychological level, this closely parallels the internalization of costs in economics. Both recognize that the technological program must ultimately fail, that the technological fix cannot work forever, that life will elude infinite control, and that the debt incurred through the destructiveness that arises from our separation must inevitably be paid. Every technological fix by which we generate yet more environmental damage in order to insulate ourselves from the consequences of previous environmental damage contributes to a vast Ponzi scheme, a debt pyramid, a bubble no more sustainable than our perpetual growth economy. The longer we accumulate that debt, the greater the eventual crash, and the more complete our eventual bankruptcy. The restorative economy I have described grows out of a recognition of this debt. It's motivated by a love of the world around us, a love of life, and the love of our own lives, and a sincere desire to make amends. I have said little about the mechanisms by which the transition will take place, but I believe that the requisite changes are so deep that nothing less than a complete collapse of the current regime will do it, a collective hitting bottom. When the illusion of our separateness becomes utterly untenable, then new structures of money and economy will crystallize that enforce and embody our reemerging wholeness. How far must we fall to hit bottom? That is up to us. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. You can access this entire book online, as well as other material and information about Charles Eisenstein on the web at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy of this program and all previous episodes at unwelcomeguests.org. To catch me and hang me, my shiny black catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.